It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Just weeks after leaving the White House, President Barack Obama ranks as the 12th best U.S. president overall. That's in a new poll of historians conducted by C-SPAN ahead of President's Day. It's the first time Obama, of course, is a former president and is included in this presidential historian survey, which asked 91 historians to rank all the former presidents across 10 categories. Abraham Lincoln retaining his top spot for the third time in a row. Previous polls conducted in 2000, 2009, and now in 2017. Other high-ranking presidents, George Washington, of course, Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, all in the top five. This hour I'm joined by presidential historian Tim Walch and political scientist Kerry Covington. We'll have their comments on the latest presidential rankings as we explore how we measure past presidents and how our view of presidents can change once they've left office. Also, we want to talk a little bit later about the personality traits that may lead to success or failure as a president. And we want to ask you this hour, who's your favorite past president? Tell us why. Tell us what traits you think go into making a great president. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. If you'd like to look at these rankings, go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. We have the C-SPAN link there, so you can see all of them ranked from head to toe, so to speak. Tim Walch, Kerry Covington in our studio. Tim, Kerry, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Looking forward to this hour. You have been poring over the results of these presidential rankings, and I want to turn to you, first of all, for a reaction. Kerry, can I ask you to give us your insights here when you look at these latest rankings?
Well, they're very similar to what we've seen in the past. And the top four or five presidents, much like football perennials, are always at the top of the polls. And it tends to be presidents who faced great challenges and succeeded in addressing those challenges. And those are the people we reward with recognition as having been great presidents.
So we have in the top five Lincoln, Washington, the two Roosevelts, and Eisenhower, and then Truman in the number six position. Tim Walch.
Kerry's absolutely right. You look at those first three, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Franklin Roosevelt, each in a different century, each a different crisis. Washington, the father of our country, forming the nation. Abraham Lincoln, of course, saving the Union, and Franklin Roosevelt saving us from economic collapse. So you have those three men serving in office at a time of great crisis and succeeding, I can't say beyond expectation, but succeeding to the extent, too, that we look back on their achievements and we tend to aggrandize them a bit. And if there's anything about the survey that I want to caution people when they go to see the results is this is subjective to some extent. Yes, there are 8 or 10 categories, and there are 91 different historians, and their scores are average. So this is a pretty good assessment, but it's still a matter of the heart.
Yeah, the other thing I would add to that is one thing that helps Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt in particular retain their high stature is that they died in office right at the peak of their success. Neither president had to deal with the messiness of either Reconstruction or reconversion or the communist threat, or the moral issue of should we have dropped the atomic bomb. None of those things are placed at those presidents' feet. They go to their successors. And the reason Truman is considered a successful president, and more so recently than when he was first out of office, is that with hindsight, we recognize all of the messiness that was left behind by Franklin Roosevelt that Truman managed to tie up and put our country in a good spot. And it took us a while to figure that out, but now Truman has reaped the reward of that.
You mentioned how Truman, it wasn't recognized he would land on this great president's list. Tim Walch, can we tell, looking back, if a president was ordained or recognized early on as a great, or was that sometimes just out of the blue?
Carrie's absolutely right. Think of Harry Truman leaving office in January of 1953. His approval numbers were at record lows, I think in the 20s or early low 30s. So the bottom line is, here's a man who has done his best. He's met the challenges that Carrie talked about, and yet is his back, the American people have turned their back on him. So consequently, his reputation has continued to grow, and he certainly is now considered among the near greats. What I think should be a surprise, and to some extent maybe a little unnerving, is remember that Harry Truman was never tapped as a not only for greatness, but he would not have been president of the United States except for the fact that a large percentage of the Democratic Party didn't like Henry Wallace and didn't want him to get another term, and so they tapped a fellow from Missouri who had been part of a political machine and a U.S. senator to become vice president of the United States. We thought so little of the office. He'd only met Roosevelt twice, then becomes president, and then rises to greatness. So that was just an extraordinary achievement.
Yeah, and the fact that it's a flip of the coin is reflected in the experience difference between Truman and Andrew Johnson. Yeah. Andrew Johnson was a replacement for Hannibal.
Right.
He was a disaster.
Andrew who? Yeah. He's a forgotten president.
He was a disaster.
Low.
He was a disaster.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's kind of a flip of the coin at that point because it's not – you haven't gone through the election process. You haven't been chosen by the people. You haven't been vetted in that way. So sometimes we get a winner like a Truman, and other times we don't.
That's right. Looking at the latest presidential rankings with Kerry Covington and Tim Walsh here, you can look at them too. We have them on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, a new poll of historians, 91 historians weighing in on all of the past presidents, which now includes President Obama, ranking them according to a number of characteristics. Let me just list those off here. Public persuasion, crisis leadership, economic management, moral authority, international relations, administrative skills, relations with Congress, vision and setting an agenda, that's one, pursued equal justice for all, and performance within context of times, which you've talked about quite a bit here too. President Obama, first time in these rankings, I just mentioned pursued equal justice for all, ranked number three on that particular characteristic. That was his highest ranking. He gets only a 39, his lowest ranking for relations with Congress. So there we see how it can vary. President Obama landing overall at the 12th spot in this survey. Unusual, such a recent president should land so high in the rankings?
Oh, I think it's very tentative. Who knows what to make of it right now. I mean, just like Truman was very low and moved up.
So early presidents, new presidents, volatile when they go down
in history.
We have
to wait for the dust to settle, right? Okay. I mean, so much of Obama's legacy will be hinged on how we come to view the Great Recession, how we come to view his use of drones, and those kinds of things, whether any of his executive orders survive the next administration. There's so much about Obama that's tentative and up in the air and unclear and undecided that how he'll rank will be determined down the road, not by his stature today.
Chad in Cedar Rapids looking at the ranking and emailing us. He says he notices Ulysses S. Grant, a man of high character, and in my opinion, writes Chad, the most principled man ever to occupy the White House. His reputation is now steadily rising. Do you see how far it's risen?
Risen like 10 spots. He went from 33 in the year 2000, so 17 years later, he's 22.
Hmm.
And yet it is a scandal-ridden administration. There's a wonderful line that
Chad,
said that,
put your hands over your ears.
That's right. It said U.S. Grant understood horses better than he understood men. Schuyler Colfax and so many others in his administration were, charged with crimes and castigated. So he was a very successful general and a great memoirist. One of the great works of American literature of the 19th century are Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs. But generally, he's been fairly low on the ranking among presidents and virtually all the categories. But as Chad suggests, he's moving up. He has his fans. So all you Grant people out there, take heart. He might move up even into the team.
Who is your favorite past president? That's what we'd like you to weigh in on this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page to find the C-SPAN link that can give you from 1 to 43, 44?
44.
Okay, that must be a typo in my notes, because of course there are 44. Obama was 44.
And Grover Cleveland is 2. I think we've had 45 presidents. And
so he gets to be two numbers?
He's 22 and 24, I think.
Okay, and maybe that's why they're saying 43, because actually they're 44 positions.
44 men who served in 45 positions.
Okay.
Is that confusing? I hope so.
Let's move on. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tina is with us from Cedar Rapids. What do you want to – do you have a favorite past president you'd like to remind us of, Tina?
Yes, I do. You know, I have young children who are in second and third grade, and as they study Washington, I've really come to have a new respect for Washington as a president. Being the first one, you know, you have the chance and the responsibility to set a lot of precedents, including, you know, he set the two-term. He could have been emperor. He could have held that position until he died, and he chose not to. And I really don't think I understood that until being an adult, approaching middle age, and having my kids learning about him.
Right. And
George Washington has great respect.
Right. I totally understand where you're coming from, Tina, because in an era where we see politicians want to hold on to power forever,
He didn't even want to run. You know, he did not want to be the president. So he was the perfect choice for that first president, because I think he had a lack of attachment to it, where he didn't need the power, he didn't want the power, so he made good choices for us for long term.
Mm-hmm. Tim Walsh, weigh in on his.
Yeah, Tina's absolutely
right on.
Everything, keep in mind, everything that George Washington did related to the presidency was unprecedented. He established the blueprint for those men who followed him.
Let's say if a president, if he had wanted to be president for life, would we have that today, perhaps?
Yeah, Kerry.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, we might not even have a United States. He was offered control of the government by his own army before the Constitution was written, and he faced them down and embarrassed them, and they backed off, and mutiny was averted, and we moved forward with civilian control of the military. But we could very easily have gone down a different road if he'd wanted to be a military dictator in the 1780s.
And he had a strong cabinet, too. He was a man of a lot of self-confidence and was able to work with strong figures like Hamilton and Adams and Jefferson. So, yes, there's no question that he ranks among those top three. And, of course, because it is subjective, there are people who would put Lincoln first and then Washington and then FDR, or they might swap Washington and Lincoln. But there's no question we see those three differently than the rest.
Right. And the other thing I'd say about Washington is that he stands alone in terms of the trust that he engendered in the country. That one of the points I make to my students when I teach my classes is that one reason Article 2 of the Constitution on the presidency is so short is they really didn't know what they wanted a presidency to do or be, but they knew who they wanted to hold the office, and they knew that Washington would establish the precedents and the practices, and they could trust him to do that. So they left a lot of ambiguity there, whereas the Congress is laid out in great detail because of the trust they had.
That's
in that man.
That's an excellent point. Absolutely.
Kerry Covington of the University of Iowa with Tim Walsh, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Kerry Covington on the faculty in the Political Science Department at the University of Iowa. Join our conversation with your favorite past president. Tell us why. 1-866-780-9100. I see Tim on my screen in Mason City, and Tim is cheerleading a favorite president. Who is it, Tim?
Chester A. Arthur.
Chester Arthur. There's one we don't hear much about. What do you like about him, Tim?
His integrity and coping with adversity. As I understand it, he benefited from the patronage system in New York City, was fired by Grant, came back later as a VP to Garfield, who unfortunately was assassinated by an office seeker. And Arthur took, you know, I don't know if he wanted to, but he wound up being president. and did a whole lot for civil service and to stop patronage and nepotism.
Okay, so he receives a ranking in this 2017 survey of 35th, below the midpoint. Sorry about that, Tim.
High.
Yeah, okay. any comment from
Arthur? Tim makes some good points. First of all, Arthur is an accidental president who serves as a result of an assassination, and his principal achievement is to sign into legislation civil service reform, because folks who know the story will recall that Garfield was shot by a disgruntled office seeker, Charles Guiteau. He was insane as well, but nevertheless, he had been seeking public office, and so civil service reform was called for. And as Tim suggests, he was collector of the Port of New York, a very powerful position, a member of Roscoe Conkling's political machine in New York State. And he doesn't get much credit. He served one term. He had, I believe, Bright's disease or an illness that led to death shortly after the end of his term. Often vice presidents who succeed to the presidency because of the death of their predecessor are not necessarily renominated. So obviously Andrew Johnson, who was so bitter about not being renominated, didn't even attend the inauguration of U.S. Grant. And then you have Chester Arthur and others. An individual who was enormously successful upon succeeding to the presidency was Theodore Roosevelt, who ranks fourth, I think. Roosevelt is very high in many categories. He, public persuasion particularly, could use the bully pulpit, and so succeeded McKinley. I think it was Mark Hanna, the political boss, was asked after Roosevelt was nominated as vice president. McKinley asked Hanna, "What is it that you want me to do, Mr. Hanna, in this next term?" And Hanna apparently said, "Just stay alive." And of course, unfortunately, thanks to Leon Scholzog, I think his name was, who assassinated McKinley, Roosevelt becomes president and becomes one of our great ones. So Roosevelt and Truman, amazing presidents by accident.
Okay. We talked about a lot of the greatness, the successful, those deemed successful by these historians commented on by Tim Walsh and Kerry Covington. Let's look at maybe in this latest survey, one of the biggest losers, I think the biggest loser from the 2009 survey, the last time this survey came out, Andrew Jackson, number 13 in 2009 survey. This survey now down to 18. How and why does Andrew Jackson plummet?
I was looking at Arthur. Arthur, I think, fell further, but that's
okay.
But Jackson's an important one to note, which is that when he was president, people paid attention to a different set of issues. And so he was president in a tumultuous time in the sense that he sort of incorporated the West into the United States. He was the first president who wasn't part of an Eastern establishment. He brought in his own people, a kitchen cabinet, a very tumultuous president. In some ways, Donald Trump is having the same effect. He's a disruptor candidate. People didn't like him, and yet when they look back, he establishes a new party system in our country. He sort of reestablishes the foundations of what is today the Democratic Party, and so he has.
You're still speaking about Andrew.
We're talking
Jackson.
About Andrew Jackson,
yeah.
and so he's remembered. But more recently, we've paid more attention to his position and the things he did with regard to American Indians, relocation and so on, and treatment of marginal type people. And that's hurting him in the same way I think we'll see that it's hurting Woodrow Wilson.
And it's having him yanked from the $20 bill as well.
Those are true. And Wilson was as high as 6 in the year 2000. Now he's down to 11, and I think Kerry's right. I think Wilson will continue to drop as well.
Because
first of all, Wilson was an avowed racist. He was the one who held a film premiere for Birth of a Nation, that notoriously racist film, and he was a son of the South in a very racist time.
A university president
from Princeton, yes, absolutely, but a son of Virginia, and he lived in Georgia as well. So I think it becomes controversial. So issues that resonate with the American public today, there's a sense of presentism when we go back and look at these individual presidents.
Okay, let's squeeze in a call before we have to take a break. Jerry in Wisconsin. I hope you're driving safely there, Jerry. Dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead. We're coming up on a break. Share with us.
My pick is Harry S. Truman. I was in fourth grade when he turned the reins over to Eisenhower, and him and Beth got in their Packard and drove quietly back to Independence, Missouri. He okayed the dropping of the two A-bombs, which he didn't want to do, but that ended the war in Japan a year earlier. He was not afraid to make any decisions, and he made them, and that was it.
Uh-huh. So that's what you like about him. Let me pose this question to you, Jerry. Would you like to have Harry S. Truman as the president today? Do you think he could survive in the climate that we have today?
Yes, because if you recall, if you study up a little bit and read up, you probably know. When a lot of people thought he would never be able to take over being presidency as vice president, Roosevelt didn't give him that much to do. But when President Roosevelt died and he took right over, why, he was president, there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Remember his slogans of the buck stops here, and if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
There you go. All right. Jerry, thank you much for chipping that in. Jerry, in Wisconsin, in the fourth grade, when Harry Truman was campaigning. We're going to go to break in just a moment. Maybe a quick word to, you wanted to say something.
We like feistiness, and particularly as distance, we have distance from those individual presidents. So the feistiness.
Smooth the edges.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
so our feistiest presidents, Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt, but Andrew Jackson as well, and Harry Truman, and we have, as Carrie suggests, we smooth the edges. We like the spirit and the spunk and the personality, and that it adds a little zest to the greatness.
Okay, so
don't like bland, mm-hmm. and it may hurt Obama in the long run, in the sense that
being a professorial type president,
professorial, as it hurt Wilson. I mean, Wilson was racist, but also very professorial and deliberative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I hear we have a feisty president at the moment.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Okay, it rubs people the right way or the wrong way, or I guess it's somewhere in the middle. A quick word about our favorite son here, Hoover. How did he do in this latest ranking?
Poor Herbert Hoover tends to rank about the mid-30s. He's 36 in this poll. He was 34 in the year 2000. Of course, we've added two more presidents since 2000. We've added George W. Bush and we've added Barack Obama. Both, of course, are ahead of Hoover. I don't think that
he's saddled with the Great Depression connected with that.
He is, and he gets low.
Fair or not, right?
Well, right, exactly. The question is, even within the context of his times, these historians, the 91 historians, rated him 39th. So they rate him as a failure in the context of fighting the Great Depression, feeling that he could have done more.
Okay, we'll be back in just a minute. Fascinating conversation with presidential historian Tim Walsh and Carrie Covington, a political scientist at the University of Iowa, looking at the 2017 presidential rankings. It's only the third time that these historians have ranked these presidents. We want you to go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. You'll find the link there to C-SPAN. Tell us what you think of the links. Of the rankings, I mean. And give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with presidential historian Tim Walsh and political scientist Carrie Covington of the University of Iowa. Tim, of course, the former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And we are picking their brains, having them share anecdotes and insights into our previous presidents, because of the 2017 ranking of presidents. They got 91 historians across the country, and they had them evaluate all of our previous presidents on, what is it, around eight individual leadership characteristics, including relations with Congress, administrative skills, crisis leadership, performance within context of the times. And they come up with a whole ranking. And, of course, as you would expect, those top-ranking presidents include the two Roosevelts, Eisenhower. Kennedy's in the top 10, as is Reagan, and Abe Lincoln, right at number one there, too. As before we took the break, Tim, you were talking about Herbert Hoover, of course, you were the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. Carrie Covington, you wanted to add a point about Hoover and the transition to Roosevelt and Roosevelt's high ranking.
Right,
here.
Right. And they're both central to a major crisis in our history, the Great Depression. And yet Hoover's seen as the weak president, very low, and Roosevelt's seen very strong on the high end. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Hoover was president before the Depression begins, and so he's in a box. He's kind of in a mindset of looking at what can government do. He's a Republican. Republicans have spent 50 years speaking about limited government. He has a more constrained mindset. He tried to do some things, but couldn't really get outside that and be innovative. And to be fair to Hoover or to Roosevelt, he criticized Hoover for deficit spending. So Roosevelt came into office sort of inside the box as well. But being the out party, Roosevelt was able to think more innovatively, outside, creatively, spending money, building new organizations, putting people to work, and restoring confidence. I think that's the key that he did in 1933-34. The interesting thing about Hoover, though, is if he had abided by Roosevelt, the interesting thing about Roosevelt is if he had been abided by the two-term limit, I think he would be down in the teens or 20s as a president as well, because we were still in double-digit unemployment. In 1938, we turned back into another recession. And if he leaves office in 1940, he's sort of a president that we say, well, he made a good, took a good shot, but he didn't really fix anything.
Interesting.
And, nice try, but...
Carrie brings up an excellent point, and that is that we tend to look back on the Roosevelt administration and even his relationship with Herbert Hoover as sort of a melodrama, that Herbert Hoover was snidely whiplash and the country was like the fair damsel on the railroad tracks, and along comes, you know, Dudley Roosevelt who saves the day. I think there are people who believe, because, of course, we're talking about the 100 days of Donald Trump. We talked about the first 100 days of the Roosevelt administration or the New Deal. Well, it imbued a certain measure of confidence, but it didn't pull the economy out of deep depression. And so, as Carrie suggests, 38, 39, we were still mired in economic hardship, and it wasn't until 41, till World War II, that it pulled everything out of the dumps.
Dave is joining us from Riverdale. Dave, I see you want to chime in on Hoover, too. Are you thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your comment?
I'm in Riverdale. I'm actually from Coralville. This is Dave from the Santa House, Tim.
Oh, sure. Hi, Dave.
Okay. Yeah, you guys kind of stole my thunder, but would it be true to say that Hoover saved more lives than any other president ever did? I mean, this was, of course, before he was in office, but of all the people he saved lives of in Europe, and that's completely forgotten today.
Okay, Dave, good point. Tim?
In fact, when Hoover was running for office, particularly in 28, Roosevelt, who was running for governor of New York but was working with Al Smith, raised a fundamental question, and that is Herbert Hoover human? He just seems so virtuous, so extraordinary when he ran in 28. And so it's the tremendous contrast that we see, the man who swept into office in a landslide in 28, who then loses in a landslide in 32. I mean, never has anyone risen so far and fallen so far in such a short time. And so, you know, Dave brings up an interesting point. He really is the father of the NGO. And I know there have been programs at the Hoover Library that I was involved with, and just even recently on President's Day, talking about his humanitarian work.
Here's an interesting note from Nora in Mason City, wondering about Gerald Ford. Where does he rate, she asks. It's 25.
25.
She asks, he was supportive of the press corps. How might that affect his ranking? Does that play? I mean, if a president, it sounds like she's saying if a president pleases the press and is well reflected in the press, does that matter? Does that, any thoughts there?
Gary, do you want to?
I was looking to see where Ford came from. I mean, Ford was hindered at first by the pardon. People generally looked down upon him for the pardon. Now people who criticized him think it was one of the best things and most courageous things that he could have done. And I think with the passage of time, that stands out more. But beyond that, there's very little to point to accomplishment-wise for Gerry Ford. I think he has a distinction of issuing more vetoes that got overridden than just about any other president, mm-hmm. because he was presiding over a Democratic Congress that wasn't about to be constrained after Richard Nixon had resigned from Watergate.
The huge convulsions of the country was going in through from Watergate just settling down during his administration.
And he provided a calming influence. He was unpretentious, even-tempered, and that's what we needed at that time. But going back to the comment about the press, I mean, successful presidents are presidents who have a good working relationship with the press and understand the press. Obviously, Franklin Roosevelt's use of the radio and the fireside chat and Theodore Roosevelt's use of newspapers. So if a president understands the medium of expression of that time, I mean, we have a Twitter president now, so Twitter may very well be a prevailing form of communication, but certainly the two Roosevelts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one thing I would say about press relations is we don't even remember this anymore, but President Ford and Carter both reaped the whirlwind of the Nixon presidency in the sense that the press felt betrayed, the press felt tricked, and they took it to Ford and they took it to Carter. They stood up and yelled questions. They shouted over answers. And one of the things that Ronald Reagan is famous for doing is restoring order to the press corps. He demanded that reporters sit, that they raise their hands, that they not speak.
And wasn't he the one who initiated? He was the first one to call reporters by their first names.
Could be. Yeah. Could be. Yeah. That would be a good way to restore confidence. But Carter and Ford had a very rough ride with the press because of the backlash of the Nixon presidency.
I'd like to join our conversation with Carrie Covington and Tim Walsh as we look at presidential rankings, a historian's survey that came out in 2017 to look at the rankings of the presidents. We have that link on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Have a look at it. See if you agree with the ranking there. If you have any questions, also the characteristics are listed there. Moral authority upon which these rankings were arrived at by the historians. Vision, setting an agenda, performance within the context of times, crisis leadership, public persuasion, all of those are our characteristics. Cindy, with an interesting email from Ames, one measure of a good past president, Cindy writes, is whether that president was scientifically literate for his time and thought and acted accordingly. I suspect, she writes, scientific literacy will be regarded as more important by future historians. So who are our Renaissance men as presidents? Jefferson.
Yes,
Jefferson.
Indeed. Yes. But it's also true of presidents who were self-educated or who were intellectually curious, people like Abraham Lincoln and Harry Truman, who read widely. I mean, self-educated individuals have become among our greatest presidents, too. As Carrie suggested, that John F. Kennedy said that when he had a whole ballroom full of Nobel laureates at the White House, he said, never has so much intellectual greatness been assembled in one place in this building than the last time that Thomas Jefferson ate here alone.
Right. Ouch. Okay, here we go. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Joe in Donahue dialed that number. Hi, Joe. Who's your favorite past president?
Well, I just wanted to make a couple comments about Andrew Jackson. There's been some correlation, made between Jackson and Trump because they're both extremely feisty and so on, and they both claim to make great changes. I mean, Jackson, rejected the aristocracy of the East, particularly John Quincy Adams, and with Trump, we all know what he rejected there, the elite and so on. But there's about Jackson, two things, one plus, one minus. The minus, I would say, was his treatment of the money situation, how he destroyed the National Bank and really helped bring on the panic of 1837, which is the year that he left office. The positive thing about Jackson is his resistance to states' rights on the nullification crisis. He made it very clear to South Carolina that they could not nullify federal laws, and if they continue to do so, he himself would lead the army into South Carolina to restore the supremacy of the federal. So those are my two comments.
All right.
About Jackson.
All right. Joe, thank you very much. 1-866-780-9100.
Nice to talk to the juxtaposition of those two ideas.
Sure.
On the one hand, he's right. Jackson, a great shining moment for Jackson was standing down South Carolina on the nullification issue. That was really important. But on the other hand, this idea of the national bank, destroying the national bank, was precisely to give the states more power. The national bank did all its investing and lending on the East Coast, and he wanted to break that monopoly and get public funds into state banks on the West so that people could buy land and develop it. And that was the genesis of the national bank. So on the one hand, yes, he stood up for the nation, but on the other hand, he stood up for the states.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if when we look back at history, look at these rankings, these individual leadership characteristics, I wonder if we can see any personality traits that tend to predict a president's effectiveness. For instance, if a person is particularly charming or more reserved or flexible or rigid or impulsive or calculating, are there any personality characteristics we can see that translate into greatness given the times?
This is just very subjective, of course, but I think presidents need to exhibit two traits in tandem. And if one overpowers the other, then they get themselves in trouble. And the one is they need to have a clear vision of the way forward for the country. And I often talk to my classes about that in terms of having a narrative or a vision for the country and being able to express that to the people. And that's where Teddy Roosevelt's very good. Franklin Roosevelt was very good. Ronald Reagan was very good having that vision. But at the same time, being able to accommodate contrasting views and accommodate people arguing in front of them and helping them see the whole picture without that outweighing or overwhelming their vision. So, for instance, George Washington with his cabinet had a lot of diverse views, but he had a vision and he stamped policy with his preferences. Jimmy Carter had a vision, but his inability to keep his house in order muted it. He wasn't able to really express that clear vision to the country because of the divisions between the advisors he had inside his own administration.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, what Kerry is suggesting. It also is true that every successful president needs to be imbued with extraordinary self-confidence, and they also need to have a healthy ego, but the ego cannot be greater than the ability to work with others within the context of their own administration and to begin to cooperate and make deals with Congress and alliances across parties. That's a critical element to their success.
Finishing up our hour, looking back at the previous U.S. presidents, how they rank, Tim Walch and Kerry Covington with us. Let's go to Nick in Des Moines. Nick, who do you want to talk about in our previous president roster?
Yes, I'd like to talk about John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a lawyer from Des Moines, and I grew up reading some biographies and watching specials on John F. Kennedy and just fell in love. But he's not often ranked very highly, and I wonder if it's because his presidency was cut short and if maybe you could lend some insights into whether if he had more time in the White House, maybe he would be mm-hmm. ranked higher.
Well, this latest ranking gives him number 8 position. He's slipped a couple since the 2009 survey. He was 6 in 2009. What are your observations, gentlemen, about John F. Kennedy?
Kerry and I have talked about this, too. The difficulty of assessing a president who's had less than 3 years in office in at a time when his legislative agenda was bogged down in the Congress. Of course, his life was taken, cut short tragically. There was a sort of a culture of idolization that emerged after his presidency. And so it's really been a prism that's affected our ability to look at them. He ranks 8th, but if you were to take his name off of that list of accomplishments or near accomplishments and just said, what do you think of this president and what this president accomplished without the name associated with it, he probably would drop into the 20s.
Yeah, it's very much the case that the nature of his leaving office and the aura that that came with that. I think the idea of Camelot didn't actually show up until after he was assassinated, for instance. And also I'd point out that political scientists look at John Kennedy quite differently. He's rated as one of the most overrated presidents by political scientists. And on the most recent list that political scientists created, he was number 14.
Mm-hmm. But as Joe said, he loves him. I mean, the point is, right, there is a love, there's a personal relationship that many people feel toward their presidents. They used to say about Franklin Roosevelt that people had only two pictures in their homes, one of Jesus Christ and one of Franklin Roosevelt, and often they confused the two.
Oh, right. President Obama, and first time in one of these surveys as a former president. Interesting, too, Carrie, I believe you were looking at another ranking that was of black newspapers ranking presidents. That's an interesting prism.
Yeah, because of this TV show, I did a little bit of background research and discovered that someone did a study of how black newspapers had rated past presidents by the percentage of the editorials that they produced that were favorable towards that president. The reassuring thing is that they tended to follow the general pattern that we see in everything else. Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt are up at the top. But African-Americans elevate Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson's number four. Barack Obama was number five. Truman was number six. I found that to be interesting. Woodrow Wilson's quite a bit down the list on this. But by and large, they do follow presidents similar to the other ratings.
I'd like to, in a parallel analysis, I don't have the specific data here, but Catholics were very disappointed at John F. Kennedy's presidency because they had high expectations when he was elected that he would support parochial education and other issues of concern to the Catholic Church. And when he became the president he said he was going to be and separate church and state, they were disappointed. So it may be that African Americans had higher expectations for Barack Obama, and it's that disappointment is reflected in African-American newspapers.
Prior to Barack Obama, George W. Bush, I see in this latest ranking, he's benefited from the few passing of these years. His ranking has moved up to 33, up three spaces from the 2009 survey.
Here's an interesting question, because we have so many living former presidents, and although being 12th might make Barack Obama feel pretty good about his presidency at this early stage, one wonders how does Jimmy Carter feel, or particularly George W. Bush feel, about, in Bush's case, being 33rd out of 44. That's not necessarily a passing grade, as they would say.
All right. Other presidents. Here's a comment from Ellen in Cedar Rapids. Listening to this conversation, she suggests checking out the Siena College's study of first ladies of the United States. The survey has been conducted five times over the past 31 years, and you can find it, she says, by Googling Siena College First Ladies study. So there's
an excellent, excellent point. The importance of first ladies has been vastly underappreciated over the years, and we can see in each case among recent first ladies that they're an important influence.
Sure. You go to Woodrow Wilson's wife,
indeed,
who basically is running the government after he suffers a stroke. Dolly Madison was very important. John Adams' wife was very important.
Nancy Reagan.
Nancy, yeah, right. First ladies are an important component of a presidency.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. Toss out quick fire some biographies that we need to read of presidents, your favorite presidential biographies of the past.
I'll tell you, one of the things we talked about, George Washington, Ron Chernow's biography of George Washington, which, of course, parallels his biography of Alexander Hamilton. We talked about Andrew Jackson. John Meacham has got a wonderful biography of Andrew Jackson. Joe Ellis on Thomas Jefferson. David McCullough on John Adams. David Herbert Donald on Abraham Lincoln, an excellent biography. And certainly read about the founding fathers and our earlier presidents before you get into the 20th century.
Carrie Covington, recommended reading?
I'm a political scientist, not a historian.
Okay. All right. Well, that wraps up this. I don't know. Did we see when they are going to do their next ranking? I don't know. They do it every so often. We'll find the next one. This has been a delightful conversation. Thank you so much, Carrie Covington, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tim Walsh, presidential historian and a former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tim and Carrie, it's been a delightful hour. Thank you both.
Yep.
I want to remind you that tomorrow on this program, you'll hear another Pints and Politics edition of our show. That's where we take our show on the road, so to speak. Tonight, I'll be at the Mill in Iowa City. It's presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. We'll discuss President Trump's first month in office with political reporter James Lynch. Also, columnists of the Gazette, Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman. That's tonight. It's free of charge at the Mill in Iowa City, starting at 5:30. We'll also talk a little bit about state politics with the Republicans firmly in the driver's seat at the Iowa State House. So I hope we can see you tonight. Otherwise, you'll be listening to a version of that tomorrow over the noon hour here on River to River. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon with help from Chelsea Hoy and Anna Williams. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.